Accession number 10421, reel 24.
Was the morale of the men affected by the movement from fighting an enemy which they could see and they knew in uniform to a situation which was basically a civil one?
Well, at first, yes. But later on, when they were sure that they were doing the right thing, then they were okay. It was only the morale was only affected because they didn't know who we were fighting for or against. But as I say, once that was established, that they were doing the job of work that we were sent to do and it was correct, they were okay.
In the beginning, being a northern battalion, working class men, miners and so forth, do you think that their socialist feelings kind of made them understand or think they understood what ALAS was about in the beginning?
Well, I wouldn't know, but you know what a jury is. If he thinks a thing's wrong, normally he says it's wrong. And it could have had an effect on him. But I wouldn't know. I wouldn't know for sure.
Right, well, you were saying that you had a job to do the day after New Year's Day, or on New Year's Day, was it?
Well, yes. Intelligence had reported that about 60 of these ruffians, as they were called, from the hills, were holed up in a factory area on the outskirts of Athens. And we were ordered to go and sort them out. We had to attack before light. Unfortunately, the lads had been doing a bit of drinking the night before. And when I got up, expecting to see the sergeants and the men ready to move, wasn't my job to get them out of bed, of course. I was up early enough. There was nobody there that slept in. The major was going off his head, and he said, "We'll never get there now before light." And we got them ready in double quick time, and off we set with our interpreter, who was a student type, a lad. He was frightened to death because he thought that he would be taken action against if he was found.
Had he just come to you, or had he been with
you? No, the battalion headquarters must have been on the outlook for anybody as an interpreter to go with the battalion. Whether he volunteered or not, I don't know. He was a nice chap, spoke good English. But anyhow, we carted him off with us, dodging along paths and hedgerows that we could find. He started to get light. Now, in front of the factory was a great big open space. There was no cover at all. So that's the reason we supposed to have got there before light. We carried on and got to the factory, or the factory wall. The major went in, and fortunately, they'd done the same as we had. They'd slept in. After a bit of sporadic firing, we captured the lot. But before that, I was following the major, and suddenly I was fired on by a machine gun with my two lads, and we had to dodge behind a column, sort of big column in the wall. And we stayed there. We couldn't get out. So I said, "This is no good." And the fire came from a tower in the factory, a very high tower. So I took a run and dive through the hole in the wall where we got through, dashed up the side of the road, behind the wall, got a tank commander and said, just see him off with you. And of course he put the one in, he's gone and blasted that chap up there. After that, that was the end. We got them all out. Some had been shot. Sorry, a lot of dirty people there were, you know, bearded, one with his jaw shattered with a bullet. And of course then we loaded them up into trucks and ready for interrogation in prison camp or wherever they're going to take them. Now we had to carry on then. There was up this road to another factory, and as we were going up, we fired on again from up the road. The bullets weren't coming across anywhere, they're coming straight down the road, and we had to get to this factory across the road. So we had to jump across two at a time. As soon as there was a lull in the firing where we thought the chap was changing his magazine, or then I would send two men across. And that is the way we got across to this other factory. Now, this factory was a cognac factory. I was organising something, and one of the young officers got hold of my Piat man, who was two great big doors to this factory, and said, fire your Piat and burst those doors open. Of course, being inexperienced about Piat, obviously, you're supposed to be undercover to fire a Piat. You've got behind something, because it has a terrible blast, a blowback. Now he fired the Piat at these doors, hit the doors, and Wactaloni, the Piat man, finished up in hospital because he got the backlash. I had to tell the young officer a couple of the truths about the use of the Piat and what it was capable of doing, and it was dangerous if it wasn't handled properly. So anyhow, Wactaloni was carted away. He wasn't severely wounded, but he was wounded. And I can't remember whether he ever came back again. Anyhow, we got this factory, and that appeared to be the end of that campaign in Greece. The Elas had been cleared from Athens and from the town. And so we then went back to some billets in the town, everything was quiet, and we thought that was the end of that. But a day later, we were on the move again. We were ordered to go and clear another island called Patras.
Have any notion of what date this was?
This would be about the 6th of January, round about that time. And so we had to board these tank landing craft. The carriers were with us, and go right by sea to this island. Normally, we could have gone by the Corinth Canal, along the canal road, but the Elas had blown it, so it was impossible. So we had to go on these tank landing craft, which would take 48 hours or so to get to this island. Well, all the men, or a lot of the men, were seasick because of the flat bottom and they were rolling about. One of the sergeants, who was the Belgian sergeant who I spoke about when I was in S Company, he lay on his stomach for 48 hours. Never a bite to eat, never got up. Quite a few more were pretty seasick. And now eventually we landed, and we sort of stood off the island, and the brigadier gave off warning to these people that they had to hand in their arms or else we would fire. And we landed, and they hadn't handed in their arms. They weren't using them. Just had them over the shoulder there, laughing. As soon as they saw the carriers come off the ship, well, they changed the children. We got all their arms, and got them all wound up and took their arms off from them. It was a I was getting ready to go upstairs. There was cocoa on. The cooks had got a brew of cocoa and to give the men after the journey. And as I was going up, I saw this chap standing against the wall near the wharf. And I said, go on, get upstairs and get your coffee, your cocoa. And he stood there. I said, who are you? I said, what company belong to? And he said, C Company, which is my company. Well, I knew he wasn't in my company. And I said, look, I'm the sound major of C Company. You're not in my company. And as soon as that, he hit me right in the mouth. And he knocked me into the sea. Anyhow, he took a lump out of my lip underneath, which I had to cut off with a pair of scissors. Told my colour sergeant, the Gaelic hunter, who, as I mentioned before, was joined the police force when he came out of the army. I said, put him under close arrest, will you, while I get this sorted out. And, what happened? I charged him, striking a warrant officer. And the adjutant said, was he drunk? I said, well, I don't know, really. I suppose he was. I didn't want to get him into more trouble because I think he was drunk. And he got 28 days detention. He came out again, and I think he was a bit wary of me and thought I was going to sort of railroad him and have him every time I saw him. We were on the range one day, and he was on the time. I said, look, you come here. What was his name? Mac Phillips. Mac Phillips. He was one of the artillery, and he'd been a sergeant who had reverted because he wouldn't lead a platoon. Wouldn't take responsibility. Then I look, I said, I'm not. What you've done, you paid for. I said, now forget it. I said, I'm not after you. I'm not going to run after you to charge you or anything like. So that's it. And well, after that, he saw he best not friends, but it was respect. He knew that I wasn't holding a grudge against him.
What kind of things could you do to a man on detention when, in effect, you're on active service and could be in action at any time?
Well, that was difficult. I don't know where he was sent to, but normally, in action, it's a difficult thing. You can't really do anything, except if he's deserted, then he goes away into prison for 3 years. But normally, nothing. So where he went to, he probably did go to somewhere in the on the island and did a spot of detention. I don't know, but never mind. That was it. We were sent up to the airstrip, I should think it was. There was reported that some of the ELAS were holding that. That was cleared up, and that was the end of that little part. The inhabitants of Patras came out, all happy and all that, and the battalion arranged a dance in a hall for the local girls. And this night, the battalion dance band, and nobody turned up. No girls turned up at all. And apparently they were dead scared of reprisals from the ELAS because they weren't sure that they were cleared or whether when we went they would come back. So the lads were very disappointed that there was no dance. It's strange, but there you are.
Did this show itself in other ways in the normal responses between the people and the troops, this fear of reprisals?
Well, you see, we couldn't understand what they said. You know, we had to imagine what their feelings were, because if they spoke and said, well, if they speak English and say, well, we daren't do this, although we'd like to, but we daren't. But of course, we couldn't get to anything like that.
Well, usually, the British soldier relates very well to civilian population, particularly
yes.
Children, that kind of thing. That.
Yes,
did
well,
they try to keep away from
you. See, that is the difference between fighting in a place like Italy. Once you have passed, you've passed and captured a town, and gone past it, then there's nobody to take reprisals because the Germans are on the other side. But a civil war like that, is a different kettle of fish, because they could just, they weren't in uniform, they could just carry on as though they were ordinary civilian and take advantage of these later on. And that's what I think they were frightened of.
Was there any examples of the soldiers overreacting to the kind of fighting they were doing, this backstreet kind of out of the alley type of fighting?
I didn't come across any while I was there. You mean sort of taking advantage of and shooting somebody when they shouldn't have done? No. No, I didn't. I didn't see any of that at all. But of course, we heard of the atrocities that had been committed by the ELAS, and later on, which I'll talk about, is where I found them. I found all these examples of these atrocities, which was very, very, very nasty indeed. So that was Patras finished, and we then start to go back to Athens again. We got the same ships, of course, and I talked about the cognac factory that we captured, and I didn't mention the fact that the soldiers had filled the water bottles up with this cognac, and they had it was pure, any poison really. One signaler blew in the face, and he finished up in hospital. And of course, we had to get all the water bottles emptied, but we didn't manage to. Some of them managed to smuggle them away. And when we were coming back from Patras, the lads who had this stuff, even when you poured the stuff out, the alcohol was still in the water bottle itself. You could taste it. The sailors offered our chaps drop a rum, you see, and they said, "You're it all. Never mind that. You want to get some of this?" And offered them this cognac. Well, all the sailors were drunk. The ship never sailed. The captain was going spare. Major Pat Casey was saying, "Oh, Sam, Major, what the?" I said, "Well, I don't know." I said, "I couldn't help it." I said, "They've got it away somewhere." He said, "Well, try and get." So eventually, we had them all and took all the water bottles from them and sorted them out ourselves, and the ship sailed the next day. But the captain was really going spare. And so off we went, and took up our abode in a peaceful Athens. It was then February time, and the sun was coming out, getting a bit warmer, and the town was open. And of course, we were going to town, down to the cafes. I got a nickname in Athens, and it was Mavridaphne, Sergeant Major Mavridaphne. Well, I got a taste for this wine, and it was called Mavridaphne. Now, it was a black wine, and it was a tourist attraction, this wine, and it was packed for tourists and export, and it was a semi-sweet stuff, and I loved it. And I used to drink a lot of it, and that's how I got the name Mavridaphne. Now, the Mavro, I found a case of it, and inside were the instructions in English, and the reason it was called this. Well, this chap had a daughter called Daphne, and he had a vineyard full of black grapes, and he called the grapes, the wine, after his daughter, Black Daphne. Mauro Daphne. And as a matter of fact, when I came home and went to a reunion once, one of the officers that I knew there brought me a bottle from Sunderland, because I went to try and get some in the Yates Cafe at one time, and I had them running all over the place in Yates, because you're supposed to get anything there in Yates' wine lodge, and they couldn't find one. The most apologetic. Anyhow, this officer got me one, but my wife loved it as well. But never mind, that's just beside the point. But that was my nickname, Mavridaphne. I was even in the 16th Italian Journal, Sergeant Major Mavridaphne. Now we started then, and we started training a bit then. We knew that we were going back to Italy, but we didn't know that we'd fought our last battle there, of course, when we came away. And we got well in with the population, the Greeks. One of my clerk, the communist, was caught in one and was going to go back to Greece to marry her. Whether he did or not, I don't know.
They were much more free in our...
Oh, country. Yes, they were absolutely... yes, you could go into the houses and see, they knew the ELAS had been... were finished. And so they see, once the British Army got the ELAS out the road, then the National Guard or whoever controlled the country took over completely then and made sure that nobody was would get in anymore. And so they were happy. I don't think there's anything really... exceptional happened, except a lot of parties, etc. And then we started training, and I took the company out on a piece of waste ground. We started doing some elementary stuff, like training Bren gun and Tommy gun and rifle, etc., etc. And I was on this piece of ground, and there was a sort of a walled enclosure there, and we'd been there a while, and I said, "Bye. Damn smelly here, isn't it?" And the chap says, coming from there, Sergeant Major. Says, so atrocious. So I went over and I went into this place. It was a cemetery. And all the bodies were laid out for identification. Brown. Breast cut off. Lumps hacked out the thighs. Heads off. And these were the ELAS atrocities that we'd heard about. And it was a terrible sight.
These were the Greek men and women, were there?
Oh, yes, one? Greek men and women, yeah. They were terrible. It made you sick. We didn't stay there long, you'll believe me, and of course we didn't do our training there anymore. It was really, it really sickened the lads as well, and they knew then what they'd been up against. Absolutely ridiculous. And they could see now why these chaps were using women to go in front of them so that we wouldn't fire, and it proved that they felt a lot better, really, to think that these chaps had been... people like that.
You weren't involved in discovering them, because they must have melted into the population, a lot of these ELAS people that were not discovered. They must have.
I should imagine so. You see, I should imagine so. Although I don't suppose once they'd been defeated and there wasn't a strength there that they would give up. Well, they must have done, because I don't think there was any more trouble in Greece. Well, there has been, but... I don't think so in that respect. There was two factions, actually. There was the ELAS and there was the EPON, which were two different classes, but both against the government. But the biggest was were the ELAS. I don't know what it stood for, but they were a communist group. So I think that clears up Greece, and we then knew that we're going back to. To Italy. So we were put on a ship in about May, and off we went and landed at Taranto. And from there we went up north to the Forli area. And getting ready for a crossing of the River Po. Then, of course, we're in an area there, we're having a sort of a rest, and it was the 8th of May. And we were called all together to sit on the grass and heard Churchill's speech. European war has ended. So that started the rum ration came out.
What was he feeling at that moment?
Well, you can't express it. I'll tell you what happened. The room ration came out. Half of us didn't know where we were. At night time, I issued out all the mortar green, white, and red flares, all the vari lights, red vari lights, and we had a Guy Fawkes night. Got the 2-inch mortars out, popping them in, parachute flares, red flares, white flares, green flares, vari light pistols being fired all over, and it was a right old, nobody cared. Even shots were fired, but nobody worried.
How far were the Germans away from you at this time? Were they near to you?
No, they'd crossed the River Po. They were then into Austria, more or less.
So you weren't involved in any surrenders?
No, we weren't. Then we were packing up. We had to pack up and make our way through into Austria to Udine, which was on the borders. And as we were going along, of course, all the German prisoners were marching along the road. Officers on horses with their pistols, throwing them down towards. And still as arrogant as ever, the officers, of course, wouldn't walk with the men, ride horseback. And then suddenly an order came to take positions. Take positions. Well, it was Tito. He's getting a bit naughty. So we thought, hello, we'll... And of course, the rumours came, all the guns have been turned round, facing Yugoslavia. And he thought, oh, my God, don't say we've got to start again. Anyhow, it was all sorted out. And then we carried on into Austria. And I finished up at a place called Bleiberg. The company headquarters was a post office. And, of course, all the partisans were around with their red stars on, their pistols, rifles, women with grenades, everything. Of course, these had to be dealt with, you see. But you had to be very careful. And inside these buildings, the piled up with pistols. I think every man in the battalion had a pistol of some kind. Well, that had to be stopped. So, Pat Casey said, right, Sergeant Major, all the pistols be handed in with a label on with a man's name. And so we got that. We got all the pistols, and very dangerous of them to have these things, because some of them didn't know how to use them for a start. Foreign weapons.
Who were these partisans in Austria? Were they communists?
More or less, yes. I think they were, yes.
And they were Austrians?
They were Austrians they'd be Yugoslavians come across the border, you see. I think that was a part of the trouble then. And anyhow, we collected all these pistols up, and he said, now take a jeep out and dump them in the river. So I took a jeep out and all in boxes and dumped them all in the river. He said they're not getting them back.
So there's a river full of revolvers.
There's a river full of revolvers. So, and of course, I was sitting in this office, looking at all the German stamps with Hitler's head on and all that. And the prisoners were filing through, and this chap came in. He was about 6'5", a German, spoke perfect English. And he said to me, can I speak to the officer commanding? I said, no, you can't speak to the officer commanding. He's out and I'm in charge. What do you want? He says, I come from Bremen, a place where your heavy bombers have been visiting a lot. He said, I'd like to know when I can go home. I said, get on the end of that queue there. It'll take you about 4 years. That's arrogant. You see what I mean? And that's what they were like. Still, when can I go home? And all our prisoners stuck in Germany, they had a prisoner war camp for 5 years.
So what were you doing at this time? You were collecting.
We weren't doing anything except going to a place where we would form up and see what the position was.